Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Glenn and Helen Show. Today, our guest is someone who needs no introduction, Senator John McCain, Republican from Arizona.
We talked to him about immigration, the Second Amendment, campaign finance reform, and why he thinks Bush needs to veto an appropriations bill.
He also had some thoughts on the role of the blogosphere and said he'd support federal legislation to prohibit gun confiscations like those after Hurricane Katrina. So stay tuned.
Okay, we've got Senator McCain on the phone now. Hi, Senator McCain.
Hi, Helen. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Well, it's hard trying to do the Lord's work in the city of Satan.
So is this your first podcast?
Yes, indeed.
And what made you decide to do one?
Well, because Glenn is such a powerful and influential American, I thought that this would show up any ambitions I might have for the presidency.
And I know you did a blog post with Porkbusters last week.
We did a little bit on spending, which is we all know is out of control and has caused great disaffection amongst our Republican base. If I just could make an additional comment, you know, in politics and life, there are tipping points, and this the bridge to nowhere that appeared on the cover of Parade and that. Insert that is in the Sunday newspapers all over America, I think was a tipping point. $233 million bridge to an island with 50 people on it. We could have bought those 50 people each a Learjet for the cost of it. And when I go to town hall meetings and Republican gatherings, I ask people who here has heard of the Bridge to Nowhere, and literally everybody has. And they're sick, and our Republicans are sick and tired of it.
So what's your position on Senator Coburn's legislation for greater transparency in the legislative and appropriations process?
I'm the first co-sponsor. One of the great fun things that I've experiences that I've had here in the Senate is working with Tom Coburn. He's got guts, he's got brains, and we have been working very closely together on a number of spending issues, and I can tell you I admire him enormously for the courage that he's shown taking on the issue in the way that he has, not only because going after the earmarks, but trying to reform the system, which is really the only way we're going to cure this problem.
Well, I imagine he hasn't made a lot of friends with that.
He has stolen the title of Miss Congeniality away from me.
Well, now, do you think you'll be getting more into the blogosphere at this
point? Oh, yeah, I think we all should. I think it's important. I think it's we've seen the effect that good blogs have on the mainstream media and on informing Americans, and more young Americans, including all my kids, get involved. Then we're seeing a change. An incredible change in the way Americans communicate, and not only Americans, but people throughout the world communicate.
So do you think blogs are going to play a bigger role in the coming campaigns? And do you think the FEC was right to include them in the media exemption to campaign finance law?
I think they were right too. And I think they're going to play a much bigger role. Like Americans used to want to be able to get the news, and when they turned on the evening news, then they would like to see the news as it goes through its hourly cycle on the cables. Now they want it instantaneously, and they want an opinion of the news. They don't want it. They not only want the facts; they want to know people's opinions on it.
What do you think about that? Because I notice there's a lot of polarization out there in politics and on the blogs. Do you think this polarization is a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's bad in that sometimes it spills over into attacks on people's character and integrity. I don't like that. I don't think it's good to personalize our differences, but I do approve of the passion. The passion should be there. We feel strongly about issues that affect the future of America, but I would not like to see us cross the line into personal attacks. And a lot of people, look, everybody's free to blog, and you know, but sometimes some of the stuff that comes across are I don't think terribly helpful, and in maintaining the discussion, the dialogue, and the debate. But I do think it's right, and this is a very important way for us to passionately defend the positions and the views that we hold.
Yeah, I think it kind of sorts out. I mean, there's certainly, especially on the left right now, a lot of anger, and it sort of reminds me of what you saw from some Republicans back during the Clinton administration. But I think it sort of, after a while, people realize that that doesn't win many friends. It just influences people.
Yeah, and Glenn, maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but I regret some of the things that are being said about a guy who is a decent and I think very fine man, Joe Lieberman. Mm-hmm. I can understand why people would not be happy because he supports the war in Iraq. That's, you know, that's their privilege, but I don't think that makes him a lesser man. He happens to be one of the more decent people that I've ever had the privilege of knowing.
Well, you know, I'm not a politician myself, but I spent some time in Tennessee politics when I was younger, and there was more sort of a culture that you could disagree with somebody and you could call their positions idiotic, but you didn't call them an idiot. You know, that you didn't personalize quite so much. And I think we've lost that nationally.
I think that's a point I'm trying to make. Passionately disagree. The more passion and the better the argument and discussion is, but don't let it spill over into a personalization or an attack on another one's character or integrity. You know, one of the things that I've found in my years in the Senate is that I can get into a terrific debate with my philosophical opponents. But as long as I don't attack them personally, we can shake hands and walk away at the end of it. But if you get personal with them, then, which I very much to my regret have done in my early years in the Senate, then they never forget it. And that's human nature, and we don't need it.
Well, you seem good at crossing over. I mean, you seem to work very well with Republicans and with Democrats on different bills and things. How do you think you're successfully managed that, or are you successful at it?
Well, I think there's one of the problems that, along with this personalization that has existed, is that we have to work on issues that are important to the country that sort of transcend politics. Example, I think, is that we have to fix Social Security. In 1984, Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill stood together in the Rose Garden and said, look, we're going to fix Social Security, and by the way, it's going to be some tough medicine. And they did fix it for quite a period of time. We can't seem to get Democrats and Republicans to sit down together. With the president's State of the Union message the last year, he said, I regret we were unable to reform Social Security. The Democrats stood up and cheered. Now, why would you want to cheer about the fact that we couldn't fix a system we all know future generations of Americans are going to have fixed? You see, that's where we've lost this dividing line between working for the country and yet still holding differing philosophical viewpoints. So we got to get back to it. I have had the privilege of working with a number of Democrats, and one of the reasons is for practical reasons. You know, it takes 60 votes in the Senate to get legislation passed, but at the same time, on philosophical difference, size of government, regulation, role of the states, national security, and a number of other issues, I have had spirited, fundamental differences with my Democrat colleagues, and as long as we have two different philosophies, we will continue to hold those differences.
Well, speaking of different philosophies, let's turn towards the war. I know that you've been a strong supporter of President Bush on the war. Where do you see things going between now and 2008? Do you think that the war is going to be a big issue?
I don't know. I think that every speech that I give, I try to make the following points. It's long and it's hard and it's tough. We cannot afford to lose it. If we win, I believe it'll have an incredibly beneficial effect throughout the Middle East. But we've got to be patient here, and it's very, very, very tough. But the consequences of failure are profound. When we left Vietnam and came home, the Vietnamese didn't come after us. That's not true with Al-Qaeda. These people are out for our destruction. So I'm disturbed in the last few days, as I know you are, about the sectarian violence uptick and especially in Baghdad, and it's very disturbing. But again, it's two steps forward, one and a half steps back. The Iraqi military is improving significantly. The Iraqi police are not. It's some parts of the country are very calm and quiet. Other parts are not. I'm worried about the Iranian influence in southern Iraq. But I still believe that this is a government that the people will support, that the training of the military and police will proceed, and we will be able to withdraw over time, but that should be dictated by conditions on the ground and not by a calendar.
Do you think there are Americans here who want us to see us lose the war? I mean, it seems that way to me sometimes when I read and, you know, look at some of the blogs or some of the newspapers, you get a feeling like there are Americans out there that really act as if they want us to lose.
Well, if they do, they fail to appreciate the consequences of failure. It would be chaos in the Middle East, among other things, and they would just become a training ground for terrorists. I was very pleased at the debate we had in the Senate a few weeks ago. You had a Democrat resolution that basically called for either a time of withdrawal or, quote, withdrawal. And we were able to prevail in the debate and in the vote by saying, look, that we're all for withdrawal. No one is against withdrawal, but it's got to be dictated by how we leave, not when we leave. And we got overwhelming votes. John Kerry got 13 votes for his proposal, and I think Levin and Reitz was, I think we got 60 against it. So I'm glad we had the debate, because it shows the American people are very frustrated about Iraq, understandably, but they're not ready for us to leave unless conditions warrant it.
We've seen a lot of intelligence failures and leaks at the CIA and in other agencies. Do you have any suggestions on what we ought to be doing to clean those messes up and get the leaking under control?
You know, I don't, Glenn. I regret it enormously. I think that some of this has clearly been harmful to our efforts to win this war, this long struggle that we're going to be in and that we are in. I worry a great deal about it, and you wonder about people that leak it. I think that the newspapers have an obligation, obviously, to consider national security. But isn't the greater burden on those that are doing the leaking? Why would they do such a thing? You know, you wonder why. Because they're smart people. They know that a lot of this can be damaging, or at least some of it, to national security. Now, having said all of that, there are times when stuff should be leaked if the government is doing wrong. You know, that's why we protect whistleblowers.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very disturbing. I see an increasing adversarial relationship between the media and the administration that sometimes I'm not sure borders on being unhealthy.
I think that's right.
I wanted to ask you about the Second Amendment. I know that I've been reading a lot about you and sort of trying to figure out your position on gun rights in the Second Amendment. It's really important to me. So could you tell me your stand on gun rights?
Well, I've always supported the Second Amendment and the right of citizens to own and use a gun. Several years ago, I supported ballot initiatives in two states to close the gun show loophole, which was that small gun salesmen were able to sell weapons without any restraints, and those passed in those states overwhelmingly. But I have supported the gun liability bill that we passed recently, as you know, and have been a strong, as most of my constituents in Arizona are, strong supporter of Second Amendment rights. The NRA and I had a difference on, as I know I did with Glenn, on perhaps the campaign finance reform issue, but my relationship with the NRA has been good.
Would you support bills to protect citizens from illegal gun confiscation, like what happened in New Orleans after Katrina?
Sure, absolutely.
Well, that kind of tells you where we're coming from. I mean, we're basically sort of libertarian types who've leaned Republican for the last couple of elections. And now, you know, we're seeing a lot of big government and big spending from Republicans. And what do you think the Republicans can do in 2006 and between now and 2008 to win people like us over?
to be frank with you, from some of my encounters with a lot of our Republican groups, it's going to be tough. And I'm not worried about them voting Democrat. I am very worried, though, that some may stay home because they'll say, what's the difference? First of all, I think that it would be very helpful if the president vetoed the next appropriations bill that has one single pork barrel item on it. President Reagan used to do that so beautifully, in both entertaining and effective style that he had. When he vetoed the highway bill in 1984 that had 52 pork barrel projects on it, he said, I haven't seen this much pork since I gave out blue ribbons at the Iowa State Fair. By the way, this last highway bill had 6,140 earmarked projects on it because the evil has grown so much. I'd like to see that. I thought a terrible mistake we made was the passage of the Medicare prescription drug bill because it added a huge unfunded liability onto the Medicare system. I think that we should set a budget and stick to it. One of the things we might do is chart a path to a balanced budget, even if it would be 3 or 4 or 5 years. Say, okay, we're going to balance the budget by the year 2010, and here's how we're going to do it. In other words, lay out a path to a balanced budget. There's a number of things that we could do, but the main thing for at least part of our base is to show that we're serious about restraint of spending, and elimination of earmarked projects would be one of the most effective ways to do that.
Well, you know, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. There's been some talk of you pairing up with Jeb Bush or Condi Rice in 2008. Is there anything to that?
No.
Okay. I'm reading too many blogs.
I haven't decided to do it, whether to run or not, but I would make a comment. Of course, I'm a great admirer of Condi Rice, and I think she's doing a great job as Secretary of State. But I would like to point out that Jeb Bush has been an incredibly successful governor of the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. And they're ahead of literally most every state in the union on education. And Jeb Bush knows education better than anybody I've ever talked to, just about. And he remains, after 7.5 years as governor, a very popular governor. That's hard to do when you're a governor, you know, because you got all that responsibility. I'm a great admirer of Jeb Bush.
Well, that kind of segues to another topic, which is you've been a supporter of a fairly open stance of immigration, and I know there's been a good deal of unhappiness on that from some segments of the base. What's your response?
I really feel, Glenn, that this is a defining issue with the Republican Party and the nation. We've got a situation that's 40 or 50 years of failed policy. Federal policy has put us into this situation where we have broken borders and 11 million people washing around our country in illegal status. And we all agree that the first priority has got to be in border enforcement. And by the way, I'm very proud of the president's leadership that he's displaying on this issue, since, as you just mentioned, there's some parts of the party that don't agree with it. But we need a viable guest worker program, and we need to have some way for these 11 million people to earn, and I emphasize earn, citizenship. And the proposal we have is a pretty tough row to hoe. Learn English, pay background, back taxes, take a background check, pay a $3,000 fine, work for 6 years, get in line behind everybody else, and another 5 years or so before you can obtain citizenship. George Will wrote not long ago that if we wanted to round them all up, it would take 200,000 buses from San Diego to Seattle, and I don't know how you would do that. So we all agree that our first obligation is border enforcement because it's a national security issue, particularly after 9/11. Where we differ from our House friends, and we've been trying to initiate and have dialogue with them, is that they believe that that's enough, and we believe that you've got to have a temporary guest worker program and somehow dispose of, in a humane fashion, these 11 million people. By the way, I was down in Florida yesterday. It was in the paper that 3 to 5 million oranges are not going to be picked because of a labor shortage. And I just talked to Larry Craig, he's saying out west in Idaho and Oregon that they simply can't get people to pick fruit, and there's going to be huge losses in the fruit industry out there because they just haven't got workers.
Is this because some of the illegal Mexicans are going home already for fear of stepped-up enforcement, or what's going on with that?
They're going to other jobs, for one thing, and they're just not working, some of them, but they're going particularly into construction and other businesses.
But how does that work with people? Say, for example, we have a lot of construction workers around. We're in a new neighborhood, and does that drive prices down? I mean, there's a lot of the American workers who aren't able to get as much money as they'd like because there's so many illegal, you know, aliens here that can work for cheap.
Yeah, but as you also know, Helen, unemployment is very low in most parts of America, and the pay that these people get generally is fairly good, pretty good, and there is a labor shortage in some parts of our economy. A great debate is going on now is whether illegal immigrants keep wages low and therefore harm people's ability to move up, or is it that they're just filling jobs that Americans won't do? You know, I think the truth lays somewhere in between on that, but I do believe in the agricultural sector that really Americans don't do those kinds of jobs anymore. I wish they did. They're very tough. As you know, it's very, very tough to pick lettuce in Yuma in the hot sun. But I think we can solve this because if we had a temporary worker program, part of that would be the Labor Department would say, okay, we've got room for X thousand jobs in this sector, and we'll authorize temporary workers for those jobs. And then a employer has to advertise a job for 60 days over the internet and a whole bunch of other ways. And if no American comes forward and takes that job, then he can enter into a contract with someone in another country. They go to our embassy, they get a tamper-proof visa, and they can come and work. And as long as they're working, they can stay. When they stop, they have to go back. You see, then we would know that these people are only taking jobs that Americans have not filled. Today, there is a legitimate discussion as to whether they are taking jobs that, you know, at higher wages Americans would do. See my point?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let me be sure I understand then. You are in favor of a fence like the House people, but you're in favor of additional measures such as the guest worker program on top of that? So it'd be like fence plus?
Plus some earned citizenship for the 11 million. It's the exact same position that the president holds.
Now, what about people who want to come here? For example, we have relatives that in Nigeria, and they're not able to get over here legally. I mean, what do you say to people like that? I mean, it seems unfair to me that these people that are already here are going to be able to stay.
They had an amnesty in the 80s, and it didn't work, and it was wrong. And they just declared amnesty for them. My answer to that is that these people have broken our laws that have come here illegally. That's why we make it so tough on them and have to go through so much in order to earn a citizenship. I don't know what else do you do with the 11 million people. I don't know how you...
Yeah, it's hard, but I think one of the problems is people see this as being illegal. In other words, if I
broke
the law and then you're telling me, well, we're going to put you on probation, we're really not going to do anything to you, I think that's where the anger and the base is coming from.
My Nigerian sister-in-law, who's a legal immigrant here and had to jump through a gazillion hoops to do it, is just furious at the idea that illegal immigrants are going to be allowed to become citizens at all.
And I understand that, and I appreciate it. But I also believe that when I began our conversation, this is a failed federal policy, and faced with the realities of one, leaving them washing around in our society, or two, deporting 11 million people. Mayor Bloomberg testified last week. He said the economy of New York City would collapse, or making them pay a very, very heavy fine and stiff penalty, but not interfering with the existing CIST quotas that exist from Nigeria or any other country. In other words, it wouldn't impact them in any way. And I agree with you, the worst part of the system being broken today is that it's so discriminatory. The closer you live to the United States, the easier it is to get in. If you're in Nigeria, then it makes it tougher. And people, and I understand their resentment. I'm just saying, if that's not the answer, come up with a better answer for me. You
well,
see what I mean?
Yeah, it's a tough one.
It's a broken system, and we're trying to find a best way to fix it. And I understand that particularly people in a country like Nigeria, by the way, doesn't have a big quota. So they've waited for years to get into this country, and then they see somebody who came here and worked. Well, we're going to punish them as hard as we can, but we don't think the answer is to round them up and send them all back, because we don't think that that would be, you know, of the 11 million people, they have 3 million children. And as you know, anyone born in the United States, according to our Constitution, is a citizen. Glenn and Helena, I'm not saying this is easy. I'm saying it's very, very tough. And I'm saying it's a product of failed federal responsibility, not state, federal responsibility. And we're trying to find a way out of it. The status quo is certainly not acceptable. Broken borders and 11 million people, soon higher than that, living in our country. And finally, I just mention 410 people have died in the desert of Arizona last year trying to get across, children, young girls. There's a humanitarian side of this, too, because probably the scum of the earth are these coyotes that bring them across the border and say, oh, by the way, Tucson is right over the hill, and it isn't, and they die.
Yeah, and I'm very torn on it, because it is, you know, I tend to favor open immigration in the abstract, but it is a tough issue, and especially when you see people who, to coin a political phrase, work hard and play by the rules, feeling like they're getting the short end of the stick on it. It's kind of tough, and as you say, we've got a family issue here.
But can't we as citizens and Republicans sit down and have a dialogue and find out the best way to work this out? I think the president's position, and certainly mine, is as long as you're in favor of a comprehensive approach to it, then literally everything is negotiable. Congressman Pence from Indiana came up with an idea that he calls Ellis Island centers, where people would have to go back, check through these, quote, Ellis Island centers in order to get back into the United States. I don't particularly agree with that, but it seems to me that that should be discussed.
Well, I think it's going to be very interesting. What other issues do you think are going to be hot between now and the 2006 elections?
War in Iraq is obviously the overriding issue. I think immigration, I think with our Republican base spending, this Iranian and North Korean crisis are of the utmost seriousness. I'm very worried about Russia's plunge towards autocracy. I believe that we're not getting cooperation on North Korea like we should out of China, who are the only ones that have an influence. I worry about conditions in our hemisphere, such as this guy in Venezuela and Bolivia. By the way, we may have dodged a bullet in the Mexican election. Domestically, I think that we will continue to have people worried about having health insurance and this new globalization of the economy, which causes people to have a lot more movement in the job market. That's why you see this belief that the country's on the wrong track when we have a very good economy. We've got a lot of challenges that we are facing, and I don't mean to prioritize them, but I'm very worried about North Korea. I'm very worried about Iran, and we've got to win in Iraq. And I'm not saying those are more important issues, but there certainly are some threats to our national security that are very, very challenging. But I also, by the way, applaud the president's handling of both the Iranian and Korean crisis. I don't know what else he could do. I'd be glad to talk more about it, but these are very tough challenges.
Well, I know we're almost out of time, but before we go, any words to your supporters and detractors in the blogosphere in particular?
I say keep up the good work. Don't get too angry. Please try not to get too personal. I pay attention to the criticism as well as the scant praise. I think that this is incredible, new, exciting method of communicating, and it makes every person a publisher that wants to be.
You think you'll be a blogger one day?
I'm probably too old for that, Helen. But I do believe, like kind of we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, I think that you're going to have good bloggers. If I may be a little subservient here, like yours, do well. We've already seen that, and bad bloggers sort of die on the vine, and that's the way it's going to turn out, and that's the way it should be.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having
me.
We
really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. And you all are in Tennessee.
We are. We're in Knoxville.
Knoxville.
Yes.
Well, that's a very lovely place.
It's beautiful. Have you been here?
Yes, and I've also been to Nashville, where my son attended Vanderbilt University.
Yeah.
And he loved it there. It's one of the most beautiful campuses there is.
Well, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Have a great night.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So what did you think of Senator McCain?
Well, I think he's got a good point on anger management and the importance of civility. It's fine to point out the issues and debate those, like he said, but the personal attacks are usually a really bad idea.
Yeah, I think he's a guy who's worked pretty hard at self-control himself and kind of knows about that. I thought it was very interesting that we wound up spending so much time on immigration. That seems to me to be the real hot-button issue in the Republican Party these days.
Well, like he said, if anybody's got a better idea on immigration, I hope they come forward soon.
Well, they'll be coming forward at the voting booth, if nothing else. We hope you enjoyed this interview. We'll be back with another one whenever we feel like it. You can check our archives at glennandhelenshow.com or check for updates on our blogs at instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com. Until we're back, have fun on the internet.
Talk to you next time.